This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton in for Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of the program. Shorter conversations to wrap up a few of the news items that were happening this week. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll talk with a storm chaser about what he saw during Wednesday's severe weather outbreak in Iowa. And then we also have a remembrance of Chris Cornell, lead singer of Soundgarden, who died this week. Well, the more money a school district spends on busing kids to school, the less it has for teacher salaries and textbooks. Transportation costs are creating an education funding disparity between rural and urban Iowa. Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden is here to talk with us about that. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Ben.
Sarah, before we get to what you found out in school districts in Iowa, we also want to spend a few minutes on another story that you covered this week. News that Planned Parenthood will be closing four of their Iowa clinics. So take us through, well, why are they closing?
Yeah, so as I'm sure listeners remember, this year the Iowa legislature voted to discontinue the state's participation in a Medicaid program that provided Iowa about $2.9 million in family planning funding. And instead, Iowa created a new family planning program with state dollars. And this way, the state can exclude organizations that provide abortions from receiving state funding. And Planned Parenthood is the largest abortion provider in the state. Now, I want to point out before we continue with the story that Planned Parenthood didn't use Medicaid reimbursement dollars for abortion services, but anti-abortion activists argue that by giving any money to Planned Parenthood, it still indirectly supports abortion. So just a clarification there.
And there are four clinics closing, but how many are of how many total?
There's 12 clinics in Iowa currently. That's going to change this summer down to four. The clinics closing are in Sioux City, Keokuk, the Quad Cities Clinic, which is in Bettendorf, and also the Burlington Clinic.
Okay, and quickly, there's a lawsuit going on. Is there also any relation to that lawsuit?
Not directly, but it's interesting. So the lawsuit asked whether it places an undue burden on women in Iowa to force them to wait 3 days in between two appointments when seeking abortion. And this will probably require, if this law is allowed to go into effect, this will require women to travel, at least a lot of women, not all women, but many women to travel to clinics where they can receive their abortion. And so three of these four clinics do currently provide abortion services. So once they close and if this law goes into effect, that means more travel for more women.
Okay, so Sarah, we were talking about these four clinics that are going to be closing, but there have been other clinics in Planned Parenthood clinics in Iowa that have closed over a number of years. Can you give us a little big picture on that?
Yeah, so Planned Parenthood's footprint in Iowa is definitely getting smaller. Since 2011, if you include these four clinics, 16 clinics have closed. And part of that is because Planned Parenthood affiliates have merged. But there are other factors. And I think that, for whatever reason, there are fewer Planned Parenthoods now in 2017 than there were in 2011.
Okay, we're talking with Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden about Planned Parenthood. Four clinics will be closing in Iowa. And now, Sarah, let's talk about another story that you've been covering, as school transportation systems and how the cost of transportation is part of the education funding picture and the difference between those districts that are in larger urban areas and rural areas. You went to Greene County, Iowa, and had some reporting there. What did you find out?
Yeah, so Greene County is about an hour and 10 minutes northwest of Des Moines. And Greene County is the eighth largest geographically in the state. It has schools in a couple different towns, and it spends about $206 above the state median in per pupil transportation costs, and that's the state median of all districts when you look at what they spend per pupil on transportation. And if Greene County could bring their transportation per pupil cost down to the state median, they would have something like $268,000 last year. It's a lot of money. And Greene County says that primarily the reason that they have such high costs is that they're a very large district, a lot of gravel roads, and it eats up a lot of their budget. Now, it's not all the state's funding model fault. Because it has schools in a couple different towns, this increases transportation costs. But essentially, Greene County is saying that because of the way the state funds education and school districts in the state, their students are being shortchanged of education dollars that could be spent on teachers, textbooks, pretty much anything else.
That's right. So they would be able to use, if they were able to bring down the money, they would be able to use that money for things in the classroom, like teacher salaries?
Right. So the state funds education on a per pupil basis. I believe it was about $6,500 in the past school year that the state paid two districts per pupil. So, and that all goes into the general fund, and transportation costs, teacher salaries, all that other stuff also comes out of the general fund. So there's no additional funding mechanism to try and even out things when it comes to transportation.
That's right. And these transportation costs, it's not just buying buses and paying the drivers. Like you mentioned, gravel roads, you know, gravel roads, as anyone that spent any time on them knows, that can take its toll on your vehicle and buses too, I imagine.
Wear and tear is a major factor. And if you look, I made an interactive map that you can go to iowapublicradio.org and check out my web post that has additional information if you're interested in that kind of thing. And you'll see that some smaller rural districts do have very reasonable transportation costs, and some have transportation costs that are pretty high. And that's because, you know, different districts have different geographic features. Districts sometimes have schools all in one town. Sometimes districts have schools that are really spread out. So districts are very individual, but overall, the districts that are paying far more in transportation costs are the more rural districts. And the more urban districts have far lower costs.
So how do we know? I mean, we hear about the school districts consolidating in rural areas and getting smaller. It would make that transportation piece a lot tougher, I imagine.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So a lot of times school districts will consolidate with each other when they're both declining population. So District A and District B, they're next door, see each other and go, well, you're losing population and I'm losing population. Let's consolidate and then we can combine resources. But that sort of just puts a Band-Aid over the problem because, as you know, Ben, rural Iowa has been losing population for over a century now. And so when two districts combine, they become geographically larger, but they're still losing population. And Greene County is actually a consolidation of two other smaller, older districts. And so therefore, while the district kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, population continues to decline and decline and decline.
Okay, so what are these districts able to do? I mean, how can they bring down the costs? What kind of things are they working on to do that?
Well, Greene County is moving all of its schools to one town, and that will save on transportation costs. Some districts are able to buy their gas in bulk or arrange for a discount with a local gas station. There's also been a number of pieces of legislation introduced at the Iowa State House that attempt to bring equality in some way to this issue, but nothing's passed yet.
Okay, Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden talking about some of the stories that she's covered this week. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks, Ben.
And this is a News Buzz edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio. Ben Stanton in for Ben Kiefer. Let's look at the state legislature. This spring, the Iowa State Legislature passed changes to gun laws, sometimes called Stand Your Ground. Well, those new rules go into effect in July. It means that Iowans can use deadly force if they believe that's needed to protect their own life or to avoid injury. The law applies even if the person is wrong in their estimation of danger. Now this Stand Your Ground law could have its first test in the murder trial of a Des Moines woman accused of shooting and killing her stepfather this month. And joining us to talk about the details of that case, Grant Rogers, Des Moines Register reporter covering Polk County and federal courts and city of Johnston. Grant Rogers, thanks for being here.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Well, and of course, our condolences go to the family who's going through this situation now. But as to the details of the case, can you tell us, Des Moines resident Sarah Alexander was accused of shooting her stepfather, Anthony Hartman. Just take us through what happened.
Well, what we know from an interview that Ms. Alexander's mother has given to the Register, Alexander's stepfather, the victim in this case, Anthony Hartman, had been not living at the family home due to a no-contact order that was placed on him because of a domestic dispute back in November. But on May 8th, Mr. Hartman came to the home on the south side of Des Moines near the airport to pick up some tools. Now, Sarah Alexander, the defendant, apparently did not know that he would be in the house that day. And at some point, an altercation happened. And in the basement of the home, she shot him several times with a handgun that she owned.
She shot him and killed him. We don't know whether she let him in. We don't know if she she says she doesn't. She didn't know that he was going to be in the house that day.
The details are still a little bit hazy and will likely come out more as we approach trial and then throughout a trial. What her mother has told the media is that she did not know that Mr. Hartman would be at the home that day. The defendant's mother has said that she believes the victim must have done something to make her daughter feel threatened. He had a history of domestic violence and drug use that's been documented in court records. And the family fundamentally believes that something happened in the home that day that made Sarah Alexander fear for her life.
And those details would be important if the Stand Your Ground law applies. But before we get to that, what sentence, if convicted, would Alexander face?
Well, she faces a first-degree murder charge, which, if convicted, will come with a mandatory life in prison sentence without an opportunity for parole. So it's the most serious charge you can face under Iowa law, and it would require a life sentence if she's convicted. So there's a lot at stake here for her and her family as well, who... even though this is very much an inter-family conflict from what we understand, her mother and sisters are very much supporting her and want to see this situation resolved without her having to go to prison for the rest of her life.
Well, what is the defense argument?
Well, defense attorney at a hearing earlier this week announced that he intends to use Iowa's new Stand Your Ground law in his defense of this case. The law says that a law-abiding person who is in a place legally doesn't have a duty to retreat before using the type of deadly force that Sarah Alexander is accused of. And perhaps more importantly, as you've already noted, the law even allows you to be mistaken in your estimation of the danger, as long as you had a reasonable belief that the threat was real, and you acted reasonably in using that force. The way the defense has put it, the law is now vastly more favorable to a defendant like Sarah Alexander.
And can you tell us, Grant Rogers, what we know about the manner in which Hartman entered the residence? How does stealth
Certainly.
Apply to this? What does that mean in this legal situation?
The law presumes that lethal force is reasonable if a person who was killed unlawfully entered a house or a building through stealth, if that person snuck in. Now, it's a little bit unclear how that applies in this case, simply because we don't know all the details yet of what happened, but... Ms. Alexander's defense attorney certainly says that seems to apply. She did not know he would be in the house. He came in without her knowing it. So that presumption that her lethal force was reasonable should apply, according to her defense.
But that's a separate issue than the Stand Your Ground. I mean, that would be an independent situation. I mean,
certainly. It was also one change that was made to the Iowa law as part of sort of overall gun bill that passed through the legislature this past year.
So do we know yet, Grant Rogers, is there precedent for applying a law that hasn't technically, as you said, doesn't take effect until July, so this crime happened before that law went into effect? How does that affect this case?
Well, it's unclear. I don't want to speak to precedent, but it is very clear that, and I think the defense attorney acknowledges that there will be litigation over whether that new law applies to this case, simply because it was a shooting that happened on May 8th. At a hearing earlier this week, defense attorney Montgomery Brown made it clear that he feels if a trial happens after July 1, that those new changes to the law should be in effect, but it's almost guaranteed that we'll see that challenged as the case unfolds.
So what happens yet? We don't have a trial date yet.
We don't have a trial date yet, no. The next piece of the case will be Ms. Alexander entering a plea of some sort, and that should come soon.
Okay. Grant Rogers, Des Moines Register reporter covering Polk County and federal courts and city of Johnston. Grant Rogers, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio. Ben Stanton in for Ben Kiefer today. Well, fast-moving severe thunderstorms developed and tracked over much of eastern Iowa, northwest Illinois, northeast Missouri on Wednesday. You might have seen some of the damaging wind, large hail, a lot of lightning. And a few brief tornadoes also reported, including two in southeast Iowa, one in Washington and Jefferson counties near Lake Darling State Park. Another was basically south of Riverside, also in Washington County. Both were EF1 tornadoes, meaning wind of about 110 miles an hour. There's damage to farm buildings. No injuries to people reported. There's also a weaker tornado reported in northeast Iowa earlier in the week. Well, you might have heard of storm chasers, people that follow severe weather and actually try to get close to it to better predict it, document it, to get information to people. Well, one such person is Zach Sharp. He's president and forecaster for the Iowa Storm Chasing Network, and he joins us on the phone. Zach Sharp, thanks for being here.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Glad to have you on the program. And so, well, what did you see on Wednesday?
We saw a lot of rain. We saw some damaging wind gusts, overturned semis due to the 70-mile-an-hour wind gusts moving through that were caught off guard on Interstate 80. We saw large trees down, some uprooted. So it was mainly a damaging wind threat, but as you mentioned, there were some tornadoes. They were very brief spin-up tornadoes causing that very weak EF1 damage. But it was mainly a squall line event that moved through much of central and eastern Iowa.
Well, what are you and your colleagues doing when you're going out? What's your goal?
Our goal is to provide information to the media outlets and the National Weather Service to provide an adequate warning to viewers across the state of Iowa and even across the country. We go out of the state from time to time, but we are broadcasting a live signal to the TV networks, and we're relaying information back onto the National Weather Service so that way they can help aid in the process of warning. As you can see from time to time, when tornado warnings are issued, not all tornado warnings are tornado producers. So if we are underneath that storm, we can tell the National Weather Service if there's a confirmed tornado or if there's a funnel cloud, and they then put that into their warning to allow the media to broadcast that out to their followers to let them know that storm chasers have confirmed a tornado in the area, which then gives a sense of urgency to people watching it because, as research shows, people are less likely to take tornado warnings seriously unless they can visually see it or there's been confirmation from it.
That's right. And these the meteorologists, say, in the National Weather Service are always tracking the storm with all their equipment and viewing it on radar. There's a lot of information they can get with the radar. But these meteorologists and forecasters may be hundreds of miles away from the actual storm, and they need someone to be able to compare what they're seeing on the radar to what's actually happening on the ground. So you're able to connect those.
Yes, and as you mentioned with the radar, the problem with radar, they're usually centralized near the major cities. So we have one located in Johnston, Iowa, just on the north side of the metro of Des Moines. There's one in the Quad Cities. But due to the curvature of the earth, the radar beam gets higher away from the radar. So, for instance, if you're in the Des Moines metro, it's scanning the lower elevations of the atmosphere. But if you get across Mason City or Lamoni across northern and southern Iowa, your radar beam's about 10,000 feet up in the atmosphere. So you're at that point scanning the mid or higher elevations of that thunderstorm. So the tornadoes form from the lower elevations. So the further away you get from that radar, you're less likely to see the low-level rotation. So that's where storm spotters and storm chasers are heavily relied on with the National Weather Service.
So you were out there Wednesday during the events that were going on and across a wide swath of Iowa, experienced some severe weather. What's it like being out there?
You spend a lot of time in your car. We spend sometimes in excess of 14-hour days, as you can imagine. It's sort of like being a truck driver. We usually leave early in the morning to go to our target area, and we usually don't get back until after midnight or so. So you really have to enjoy your chase partner that goes out with you. We usually have 2 to 3 people in the car to make sure that way we are situationally aware of what's going on around us. We have all this information in our car. We have multiple tablets and computers. We're web-enabled, so that way we can get that radar data. We can get the National Weather Service. We have multiple forms of communication. We have ham radios. So we're always connected to the outside world, so that way we can provide information, but at the same time we can receive it to make sure we are staying safe while we're out there storm chasing.
Well, that's right. How do you stay safe? I mean, everyone else in the area is being told to find a safe shelter and to go into their basements and getting huddled down to stay safe while you're, going the opposite direction to gather this important information. So how do you stay safe?
Yeah, we rely heavily on radar data. So we have multiple different radar sources. We don't rely just on one. Just in case if one radar source goes down, we have backup radar data. But as you can imagine, we have about 2 different tablets. We have about 2 different laptops. So we're getting all this information fed into us through our vehicle, which is web-enabled. So that way we're constantly keeping an eye on what the scientific data is showing. But at the same time, part of keeping safe is looking at the storm visually, using that meteorology, background, and knowing what the storm's physically doing also plays into account onto what the radar is showing.
Well, Zach Sharp, you clearly have a passion for this work, and it's good there are people like you out there able to get good information so that the rest of us who are huddled in the basement can stay safe and know more about the storm and better predict it in the future. But how did you get into this work in the first place?
So I went off to Iowa State University to study meteorology, and I started storm chasing with some of my meteorology friends. And then when you start to storm chase, you just meet other storm chasers, and you find the ones that you enjoy working with. And then basically that's sort of how the Iowa Storm Chasing Network came about. We are just a group of guys that enjoy chasing together, and we created this Facebook page. And we now have over 130,000 followers across the state of Iowa and across the country, and internationally as well. We have followers from Australia. Usually the people that are internationally are just ones that are in love with the weather so much they follow anything weather-related. But, yeah, we started chasing as friends, and now we have this large following that we share the passion with our followers on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. So we have quite the passion for it, as you said.
Okay, well, Zach Sharp, thank you for being with us today, and continue staying safe. And thank you for your good work out there bringing us good information.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Zach Sharp, president and forecaster of the Iowa Storm Chasing Network, telling us a little bit about his experience on Wednesday during Iowa's severe weather this week. Well, coming up in the next half of River to River, some Iowans are worried that the state parks in Iowa might need to close at some point because of their situation with funding and staffing. The Iowa DNR not planning to do that at this point. We'll hear more about that from the Des Moines Register's Bill Petrosky. This is a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Stanton. Back in a minute. And we're back midstream on River to River. It's a News Buzz edition of the program. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Ben Kiefer today. Well, next, a recent look at funding and staffing at Iowa's state parks shows the Iowa DNR may need to be concerned about the risk of closing some state parks. Joining us now to talk about that issue is Bill Petrosky, senior reporter covering state government for the Des Moines Register. He joins us on the phone. Bill Petrosky, thanks for being here.
You bet.
And so, Bill Petrosky, your story analyzes the annual budget changes and says that $1.2 million less than a year ago. There are 22 state parks with one full-time employee, and there's some concern about whether if that person retires or some other changes happen, how they can staff all these parks. Can you take us through what the concern is?
Well, basically, the situation is, I covered the Iowa legislature, and as they were going through the budget, as you're probably aware, the budget has been very, very tight this past year. There's been a lot of cuts that happened during the legislative session that were really people hadn't anticipated a year ago. A lot of state revenue hasn't come up as anticipated. And what's happened is that state government under Governor Branstad has been reduced and reduced and reduced. And now that when there have to be some cuts take place, well, there isn't very much room margin for error, and that's kind of what's happening here. So, as I mentioned in the story, as folks are making plans for summer vacations, some of these budget cuts are raising worries that some of the state parks could be forced to close. And One of the situations here is, you know, talking with Director Gipp, who I think is respected by both Democrats and Republican. He says there are absolutely no immediate plans to shut down any state parks. There's no list being developed of state parks where the gates may be locked, and they want to do everything possible to ensure an enjoyable experience for park guests. But, you know, when asked point blank, will any states be parks be forced to close if this situation occurs that somebody retires and can't be replaced, he's saying, hey, look, I really can't rule out anything. But he's not going to speculate about park closures or what parks may be closed. But he does say that not all parks are created equal, because some parks generate revenue from camping fees or rental cabins, that type of thing, while other state parks don't generate revenue. So you can pretty much figure out if a state park is not generating revenue, that's probably going to be more likely to be closed.
And so the director of the DNR, Chuck Gipp, says he doesn't expect parks to close. He doesn't expect them not to either, I guess. But are there people that are saying they expect state parks to close?
Yeah, I think some Democratic legislators, I've talked with them, and they have felt frustration for some time that the Republicans' budget numbers just didn't add up to support this optimistic view. And especially when you see how much the budget has been cut, which is $1.2 million since a year ago. But as I mentioned, the budget was already very, very tight just because of previous cuts that have happened. And what they're saying is that they've been told privately by some DNR employees that, hey, look, they do think that it is inevitable that some state parks are going to be closed. And they told me that repeatedly at the end of the legislative session. Now, I can tell you that Republican legislators who are in charge of the legislature's budget subcommittees, they've told me, hey, we absolutely do not want to see any state parks closed. So my guess is that they will probably try to move heaven and earth to avoid closing any state parks. But, you know, you really don't know what's going to happen, and you don't know what's going to happen with state revenue. I just noticed that the latest state unemployment rate is that Iowa has very low unemployment rate. State revenues should be fairly decent, but we're not really seeing a lot of state revenue growth. So question is out there, you know, there's kind of a not really sure of where things are headed here.
So again, no one is saying that state parks are any in particular are going to be closing at this point, but what would that actually mean if a state park closed? And especially as you mentioned, not all state parks are created equally. So what does that mean if a state park's closed?
Well, I think what that means is that you really, if a state park is being maintained and if there isn't somebody to monitor the state park, I don't know how you can let somebody into a state park, and my guess is you'd probably actually have to lock the gates. But my guess is that what you would really see is all sorts of efforts made to avoid that, you know, transferring people in, seeing if right now we do know that, for example, that some state park and recreation areas are managed by county conservation boards. You know, I could see some effort to do something like that. I don't know if they could allow volunteers to do that. But as I mentioned in this story, right now, there's a lot of difficulty even maintaining the state parks right now. A year ago, the state typically hires about 240 seasonal park maintenance workers to cut the grass, clean up trash, pick up restrooms, that type of thing. And they're down to about 150 of those people this year. So the budget is really, really strapped. And I think you get to the point where you just have to make some tough decisions, just like they've had to make some tough decisions throughout the state budget.
Okay. Well, Bill Petrosky, senior reporter covering state government for the Des Moines Register there, talking about the concern that some Iowa state parks would be at risk of closing. Again, none of them are currently closed or planning to close, but something we'll definitely be monitoring through the summer. Bill Petrosky, thank you for being here.
Thanks a lot.
And continuing with the News Buzz edition of River to River, Ben Stanton in for Ben Kiefer. And now, well, we hear a lot about bullying in schools, and many efforts to prevent that. It can be difficult for kids to know what to do. Well, what about adults? We can be bullied too, and it's a bit of a different situation, though. We're going to talk about workplace bullying with my next guest. Stacy Ty Williams is Assistant Professor of Communication Studies and English at Iowa State University. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, glad to have you on the program. Some new research that you've done really shows that people get advice from coworkers when workplace bullying happens. So what kind of advice do people get when that happens?
Well, we get advice from all sorts of places, coworkers, friends, family members. And typical pieces of advice are, you know, that we should quit our jobs, we should stand up to the bully, we should let it go. Even some people advise that, you know, we should inflict physical violence on the bully.
And when, let's be more specific about what we're talking about. When we say workplace bullying, what does that mean to you?
So workplace bullying is repeated verbal and nonverbal acts that happen over a period of time with the intent to inflict humiliation and harm. And so key elements of that definition are that it's repeated. So someone can't have a bad day and have an outburst. That's not bullying. And also that there's intentionality there, that there is some intent to inflict humiliation and harm on another person.
And how common is this? Do we know?
Yes. Gary Namy of the Workplace Bullying Institute did this very large nationwide survey and found that anywhere from, you know, 28 to 35% of the U.S. workforce reports experiencing bullying at some point in their career.
Up to 35%?
Yes. So it's you know, it's out there. It's more frequent than maybe we think it is.
Sure. Well, another piece, if I have this right, from your study, you found that, you know, people that were targets of workplace bullying and that who got bad advice, even if they felt they got bad advice, those victims might still turn around and tell another person in that same situation the same bad advice. What's going on here?
Yeah, that was very puzzling to me and my co-author, Kathy Krohn, out of the University of Nebraska. And as we were thinking about it and talking to targets, it became clear that we really just don't have good strategies for how to deal with this. And so we haven't found anything that would have worked in our situation, or we would have employed those strategies. And so without those, we just kind of recirculate the advice that if we did take it, made our situation worse, or we couldn't, where we didn't feel that we could in the first place. And so I really think that it points to a need to really focus on and circulate stories from people who have experienced bullying and have successfully navigated that really difficult situation. We just don't have a lot of success stories out there.
Okay, so if you know, the upper limit of how many people this might affect is 35% who've experience workplace bullying at some point in their career. So most people or someone they know probably have some connection to this happening. So we may be finding ourselves in the place of being the person advising someone. So give us some help here. What should we do?
Listen, so we want to be helpful to people who are going through these painful experiences. And so we give them advice, right? That's our knee-jerk reaction. Well, you should do this or try this, because we want to try to help them. But this research suggests that one of the biggest ways that you can help people who are experiencing this is to listen and to allow people to have a space to be validated, because that's something that targets are so concerned about, that they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to report it in their organizations because they fear that either people are going to think they're nuts because this is something that happens on the playground, not in organizations, or that they're going to be perceived as crybabies or whiners. So really listening to them, validating that they're not crazy, that this is an experience that is valid. And in that space, then perhaps they can develop some creative alternative strategies to deal with this.
So maybe just by being able to talk through it, they can put themselves in a better situation to then kind of work through it on their own there.
Yes.
Well, if people that are experiencing workplace bullying, you know, don't want to report it, there's also, we have to imagine that the management and most organizations would have some role in this to play. How might that fit in?
Yeah. So if you have a supportive environment, an open environment, then these problems tend to get dealt with fairly quickly. But unfortunately, when we have difficult situations in the workplace like bullying or other forms of harassment, we often don't have the answers for it. And so managers look the other way and they hope that this is going to go away on its own, that eventually it'll just sort of disappear. And the problem with that is it doesn't. So unless people are willing to get to the bottom of things, you know, and have kind of a no-tolerance policy, then this is going to continue to fester, and it has real costs for organizations, turnover, you know, a whole slew of things, as well as for targets. And so managers need to, you know, kind of address this early on and directly instead of just hoping for the best.
Okay. And very quickly, we're running out of time, but we're talking about adults experiencing workplace bullying. Anything that you learned in your research that we can also apply to when children are bullied?
I think a lot of these things could apply. I don't study kids, but, you know, listen to them. And I think we probably recycle the same advice to them that we do to adults. And so, again, just opening up those channels of communication where people can talk and be supported. And then they can develop, you know, solutions and gain agency in addressing this issue.
Okay, Stacey Ty Williams, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Stacey Ty Williams, Assistant Professor of Communication Studies and English at Iowa State University, joining us on the program to talk about workplace bullying. That's a News Buzz edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio. We're going to move now to Cedar Rapids and talk a little bit about the Czech Republic. Well, Czech Republic got a new name, so we'll talk about that here in just a minute. But joining us now to talk about both that and the Czech Festival that's going on starting today in Cedar Rapids is Pam Lewis, board member of the Czech Village Association, and she joins me now. Pam Lewis, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Well, before we get a quick rundown of what's happening at Hobie Days this weekend, so the Czech Republic has a new name?
Well, no and yes.
Yes and no.
Yes. You know, the theory behind it is that most countries have a shortened name. So the Slovak Republic, people refer to as Slovakia. And so the current leader of the Czech Republic said, we should have a short name too. And so that's why the Czechia has been proposed. I was just there 3 weeks ago, and most of the Czechs I spoke with thought it was a very silly idea.
To say it again, it's Czechia.
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 Yeah. The I is always pronounced like an E, so it's Czechia.
So it sounds like it's not
as
something...
in.
Oh, go ahead.
Slovakia, it's Czechia.
So it doesn't sound like it's going over that well for residents of Czechia.
No, it isn't. And I have not heard anybody in the Czech community down here in Cedar Rapids talk about it at all refer to it.
Well, we'll probably continue saying Czech Republic too, then, I imagine. So,
yes.
Okay. Well, Pam Lewis, I mentioned it's the 40th annual Hobie Days this weekend. Tell us about it.
Well, we're having our 40th annual Hobie Day celebration. Hobie is the Czech word for mushroom. And we have this every year in Czech Village, which is right down on the Cedar River. The Czech Merchants Association sponsors this event. They started it about 40 years ago as a kind of spring festival. Most cultures have some sort of spring festival, whether that's May baskets or May poles or something. But we decided to do a mushroom festival because that's when the probably most popular and most common mushroom in Iowa appears, which is the morels.
That's right. Well, talk about what's actually happening this weekend at Hobie Days.
Okay, well, it sort of starts today about 5 o'clock. That's when they'll start selling morels. They will be available to buy. And the festival will continue through Sunday at about 4 o'clock. During that time, we have music, we have vendors, we have all kinds of Czech food up and down the avenue. We also have events such as, I think there's a beer run
where you drink a glass of beer and run across a bridge of the lions and drink another glass and run back and forth until you do a mile.
You doing
anyway,
that? Are you doing that one, Pam Lewis?
Right. Okay. But there's also sunrise and sunset yoga on the bridge, for those of you who do yoga. And then there's also the accordion bands playing, as well as in the evening there'll be more popular bands playing. We will have the Queens. The Czech Queens from all over the Midwest are coming in to be in the parade and participate in the Czech and Slovak Queen competition that will be going on at the museum. Puppet shows for kids. There's a cabbage roll on Sunday for children, where you see how far you can roll the cabbage down the street.
Sounds like you have quite an assortment of things going on the whole weekend.
That's right.
Well,
it's all free. It's all free. There are no charges for anything. So this is our big sort of family activity. There's a carnival down there and everything, you know, all of the village activities are free. And, oh, I forgot the mushroom breakfast on Saturday and Sunday morning. You can get scrambled eggs with morels in it for breakfast down there at the Frog Pub.
Good deal. Okay, well, Pamela, before we let you go, just remind us about the connection, about the settlement of Czechs in Iowa. How did that come about, and why is there this community of people from Czech Republic, or Czechia, as we said earlier?
Well, people have been immigrating from the Czech area, from Czech and Slovak republics, since about 1854. The big immigration came right before World War I, and many of them came to areas that looked like home. And Iowa looks like the Moravian Bohemia valleys, and so they came here. They all came because they were poor, looking for a better life, and now we have, you know, mayors and senators and ambassadors that are all of Czech descent. The Czech people have spread out. We were the fifth largest group of immigrants through Ellis Island, and we have expanded and grown and became strong and an integral part of this country. And we just spent a little time this weekend helping people remember that culture and those people.
Very good. Pam Lewis, thanks for being here today.
Sure, no problem.
Pam Lewis is a board member of the Czech Village Association. The 40th annual Hobie Days this weekend in Cedar Rapids. Continuing with our News Buzz edition of River to River today, and we'll end the program today with a remembrance. This week, singer Chris Cornell died. He was the lead singer for Soundgarden, popular during the 90s, also later singer for Audioslave. Sometimes we talk about Soundgarden as part of the grunge movement. We'll talk a little bit about that here with Michael Cross, the FM operations manager at Rock 108 in Waterloo. Michael Cross, thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
Well, remind us, and those you'll remember back to the grunge movement of the 90s, is it appropriate to have somebody like Chris Cornell and Soundgarden in that group? Does it fit into that group?
Absolutely, no question about it. Really one of the pioneers in the grunge movement, I suppose, out of Seattle.
Well, tell us a little bit about the group and how they did fit in. And maybe one thing you might think of the Soundgarden is Chris Cornell's voice itself was unique.
Very unique. No one really quite sounds like him. And, of course, those guys came out of that Seattle era where all these bands, the Alice in Chains, Pearl Jam, and, you know, certainly Soundgarden included in that. And those guys just made such a different kind of music than what was happening at the time. Because if you remember in the late 80s, it was a lot of, you know, what they call the hair bands, the Def Leppards and Poisons and Motley Crues of the time. And along came this, really kind of depressing music, if you will, grunge was. And it was a whole different kind of sound, almost kind of like an updated Black Sabbath, you know, from the heavy metal era. And it just became such a different kind of music than what was out at the time. And I think that's why it made such a difference. And, of course, Nirvana and everything changed when grunge hit.
Yeah, that's right. So, after Soundgarden was done, he did what?
Chris was involved in all kinds of different things, especially another little band called Temple of the Dog, which took parts of Pearl Jam, and another Seattle band called Mother Love Bone. And they made this one-off project in songs like Hunger Strike and Say Hello to Heaven. So he kind of did that for a while, and then, of course, ended up in Audioslave with members of Rage Against the Machine. And those guys were together in the 2000s.
And Mike Macross, FM Operations Manager at Rock 108 in Waterloo, thank you. We're going to go out with a little bit of music. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And this is Say Hello to Heaven, Temple of the Dog in 1990. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Stanton. Yeah.